Hello. Today on the Loopcast, I have Jared Holt, a resident fellow at the Digital Forensic Research Lab at the Atlantic Council, and we are discussing the current state of the right, of the extreme and the far right. So what I wanted to do with this series, usually our series on the far right and extremism in general is led by academics and analysts, people who have done, you know, thousands of page, you know, works detailing the history, detailing the influencers. And you can go back and you kind of listen to our examination of the Turner Diaries, of Tom Metzger, James Mason, etc. What I wanted to do going forward is look at the right in its sort of contemporary iteration, and it's kind of the nexus of the right, of extremism, and of politics, sort of circling around the question of what happens when we make extremism normal, when it sort of becomes part and parcel of politics. So in the coming weeks, we're going to sort of look at that from multiple angles and see where it leads us. But for today, we're sitting down with Jared Holt. So with that, welcome to the show, Jared.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Of course. I want to start off with kind of a world building question, which is we're sitting here April 14th, 2022, and where are we today and kind of looking at the far and extreme right? What is that definition that you're working from, and where, you know, from that definition, where do we sort of conceptualize its political position and its sort of placement in society now?
Yeah, definitionally, I'm thinking the far right, the extreme right being the excesses of conservative politics in the U.S. That can take many forms. It could be white supremacist movements. It could be, more, I guess, quote unquote, prim and proper hate groups. It could be hyper conspiratorial communities online. The terms far right and extremism are pretty broad. I usually use that to describe my own work just so that it, you know, everything fits under a nice, tidy umbrella. But today, I think, you know, those terms aren't necessarily useful to really convey the scale of threats that we're seeing today, both in a sense of violent threats of political violence, and also threats to sort of the framework of the democratic process in the U.S., like we saw on January 6th. Generally speaking, this field of research has made a ton of gains. I have been doing this kind of work, first research, then investigative reporting for a number of years, and now I'm back in research land. We have more brilliant people on the task than ever before, but the stakes are also a bit higher. You know, the kind of questions that folks in the field today are facing are a bit stickier, a bit trickier to answer to. One that you already mentioned, which is, you know, what happens when extremism is normalized, or if these, you know, the animating ideologies of extremism start to become more mainstream, when our elected officials are promoting bonkers conspiracy theories, or major news outlets are, you know, like Tucker Carlson's going on Fox News and in front of millions of people doing great replacement theory. How does all of that play in the mix? And does it change the way we talk about it, or does it change the way that we try to communicate the severity of consequences that could come from that? So I am optimistic with a healthy amount of skepticism, as much as anyone should, that we have, tons of great people looking at this now, more hands on deck than I've ever seen. And, you know, a willingness and sort of this political moment and political capital to make some gains here.
So with that, like, what do you see as the most kind of consequential event or trend sort of shaping this milieu of the right? You know, I think for me, like, the first thing that comes to my mind is like Trump, but that seems like such an obvious answer. But what do you see as kind of, you know, the event or a trend that's kind of shaping the right now?
Yeah, if we're talking about the really, really hardcore extreme right, the really violent right, I still tend to think that the Christchurch massacre was, you know, one of the most consequential things to happen in that sphere. It served and still serves today for, you know, the type of neo-Nazi circles and accelerationist circles that promote terrorism as a potential solution to their political complaints. It is still like an aspirational target, and it's still very freaky. You know, they're still sharing videos and clips of that awful day. But like more broadly on the far right, if we're going to kind of use the wider paintbrush to encapsulate, you know, online internet poisoned conspiracy people and you know, folks that have maybe very extreme attitudes but aren't necessarily, you know, getting ready to go out and commit some sort of mass atrocity, folks that are still trying to work within the political system. I think that Trump's election was definitely a huge watershed moment. I would agree with you there. I think the Trump era did a lot to kind of normalize these parts of the far right that, you know, had some stigma for a long time, and rightfully so, I would argue. And but I also think the 2020 election was huge for that section of the far right, because we saw it take on a more explicitly anti-democratic, or at least like democratic system skeptical posture, and a whole host of options came up on the table. You know, we have folks on the far right, whether it's elected officials like Marjorie Taylor Greene, or, you know, bloggers like Darren Beatty at Revolver, floating out this idea of, you know, a cold civil war or a national divorce. And as much as we want to pretend that's fringe, it's, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene continues to be like a highly sought after endorsement, and she's a huge fundraiser. And, you know, it's not as obscure as we might think. You know, the types of things that she says and the types of rhetoric she uses to become that top fundraiser, I think, is indicative of sort of the mainstreaming effect that the 2020 election had in the broader base. I also think it did a lot to kind of popularize among the right this idea that the whole world's one big conspiracy. You know, a lot of Trump voters still, you know, to this day, polling shows that they don't believe the election was legitimate. And I think, you know, folks are so used to hearing that maybe we don't think that much about it. But that's a pretty serious thing, to not think that an election in the country that you live in was conducted legitimacy, that the results were overturned by this conspiracy of, you know, the deep state and Democrats and et cetera, voting, the ballot counting machine manufacturers. It's a pretty wild belief, and I think can motivate people to go to some places that they wouldn't maybe go otherwise. Because if you think that the system has failed and corrupted to the point where these conspiracies are happening in plain sight and being executed successfully, I think that opens the door to a lot more stuff, and other aspects of the ideology can make some gains.
That's interesting, because the idea of normalizing a conspiracy theory is kind of fascinating to me, because Trump comes into power in 2016, and then he, you know, my timeline's going to be off, but with him comes QAnon or Pizzagate, then QAnon. And I'm kind of interested in looking at the idea of a conspiracy of, you know, Trump being the center of these conspiracy theories, and those conspiracy theories kind of being used as a constituency building tool. I mean, is that accurate, or is there something else that's going on that is kind of attracting people to Trump as a political figure within the right?
I think there's a lot of things attracting people to Trump on the right. For that conspiratorial notion, I think that, you know, the way that Trump campaigned in 2015 and the way that he and his surrogates and the media and et cetera, his allies in the media, would talk about him is kind of this like strongman, almost authoritarian figure against all of these, you know, kind of vast conspiracy theories, whether it is to, you know, whether they believe, you know, immigration at the southern border is out of control on purpose, or whether they believe that, you know, there's, you know, these issues happening and wherever they may live that are all by design. You know, Trump, I think, represented kind of an avatar that people could allow themselves to believe would, you know, fight this stuff, which they may have seen previously as kind of unmovable. It's something that was almost like bipartisan corrupt projects. Trump, being the like classic scams guy, shows up and, you know, lets him in on a scam. And, you know, he's not going to play by the rules, and he's going to go in and smash it up. By the end of it, I think the Trump presidency was, for the most part, just kind of like any other like neocon Republican presidency policy wise, as far as like what he managed to pass and what stuck. That wasn't just like an executive order that could be rescinded as soon as Biden got into office. But I think even today, a lot of his supporters still have that kind of mythos about Trump. And I think that's, you know, really what is maybe at the core of a lot of people's attraction to it.
And then he kind of ended his reign, so to speak, in 2020 with another conspiracy to stop the steal. So which I'm kind of interested in and kind of looking at the idea that Stop the Steal had enough traction and attracted enough people to it as a conspiracy that you kind of have 1-6. If you could, like, walk us through, I mean, how much of Stop the Steal was driven by Trump, and how much of it was driven like as a sort of bottom up kind of a kind of popular meme and a popular movement? Like, where do you kind of see that separation of, you know, Trump driven conspiracy and then that kind of bottom up driven conspiracy theory?
It was a bit of a mix. And this is something that we're seeing a lot these days, which is there is, you know, kind of a national establishing of message, but then a bunch of excitement that comes from a more sort of grassroots phenomena. And they kind of meet in the middle and create, you know, whatever kind of sense of panic is there that ends up motivating people and driving conspiracy theories forward like that. As far as Stop the Steal goes, very early in 2020. I want to say as far back as like February and March, I was listening to like Breitbart radio clips at Right Wing Watch. And you had Trump administration officials talking about the election. And they kept saying these lines that were kind of ominous, which is essentially, you know, they would say things to the effect of, if our elections are free and fair, Trump will win. And that kind of has the unspoken subtext of, if he does not win, it will be because they aren't free and fair. So it seemed like this was kind of a long-term thinking in the Trump administration, at least. And Donald Trump's rhetoric out on the campaign trail, especially right up there towards the end, would seem to reflect that too. I'm guessing they were starting to get some polls in-house that didn't look so good. At the same time, you had kind of the clique around Roger Stone, you know, being a longtime confidant of Trump and a general kind of rat fucker in GOP politics, who has, you know, conducted Stop the Steal campaigns under the same name via either himself at the RNC, thinking they were going to have to rescue Trump's nomination from a, you know, super delegate super delegate, something like that. I forget the terminology, but the idea that, you know, the folks at the RNC would sort of strong arm Trump's rightfully earned nomination, and that they would have to step in to cause chaos and make sure that Trump got the nomination. They didn't need to do that. Stone and his allies came up with sort of the same idea in 2016, thinking that they were going to contest the election if Hillary Clinton won. Obviously, they didn't need to do that. In 2018, they caused a bunch of chaos in Florida over gubernatorial races and some Senate races there, you know, trying to interfere and chunk up and question the counting of votes in those races. Some of them were quite close. And then in 2020, we saw, you know, kind of the same cast of characters. You had folks like Jack Posobiec, Ali Alexander, folks that, you know, I think have become household names after January 6th, at least for, you know, brain poisoned homes like my own. And, you know, at the same time that the Trump administration was kind of throwing out these, you know, subtextual nods that they were going to contest if they lost, or protest if they lost, you had, you know, this cast of characters ready to kick it in motion. And, you know, from the very onset of the election, as soon as we found out that Joe Biden was projected to be the winner, it all started to kick and spin up, started having rallies all 50 states every weekend, and eventually it all culminated in January 6th.
So it's kind of something that I find interesting before we really kind of deep dive into 1-6 is that Roger Stone, Manafort, like when we talk about normalization, we kind of have to engage history. And these guys have been with the Republican Party, I don't want to say before I was born, but at least, you know, for 20 some odd years. So in that sense, how do we sort of think about looking at Roger Stone, Paul Manafort, and then kind of comparing it to the newer sort of provocateurs like Jack Posobiec, Ali Alexander, and even Steve Bannon? How do you compare those two groups? I mean, are they just kind of a continuum of the same sort of guy going through history, or is there kind of a, would you put a difference between those sort of two clusters?
I think in large part it is just kind of a continuum. You know, the American political system will, I guess, continues to reward figures that step into those kind of roles, willing to sling some mud and play dirty. So as long as that is happening there, I guess will continue to be an incentive to do it. But more broadly, I think, you know, as we rewind history, you know, the GOP for a long time has been contesting votes, trying to pass legislation that would make it more difficult for some people to vote. And I mean, they've been doing that as long as I can remember, under the banner of quote unquote voter integrity. And, you know, I guess all of that is to say that a lot of what we are seeing today is not necessarily new, but it is like hooked up to a high speed internet modem without, you know, gatekeeping and what, you know, the typical societal forces that would maybe normally limit people's perception of it or their perception of its influence. And it feels a lot more visceral. It's like a little bit more raw today, if that makes sense.
No, it does. And I think it's kind of a problem that I've tried to wrap my head around is kind of on the podcast and in my own sort of time, we dig into the history and it's like, okay, using race is nothing new. And the anti-democratic impulse is nothing new. So ... what is new? And then it's like, oh, it's the scale and the onlinedness. I don't know what word you would use. But because it fascinates me to your point and to some of your research, like 1/6 was completely planned, at least large parts of it were planned on Facebook and Twitter. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you can, I mean, as a researcher, did you, like, what were the kind of challenges in tracking that footprint and sort of timelining that out?
It wasn't too much of a challenge. So part of what I do at my day job with the DFR lab now is just a like very vigorous daily monitoring regimen. And at the time, I was specifically focused on the 2020 election. We were looking, trying to determine the veracity or the realisticness of threats at polling locations, trying to get ahead of any of those in ways that we might felt like we needed to. And then that continued after the election. So I was kind of looking really closely at these information environments among the far right, as I was also looking for these threats, you know, going into the Oath Keepers chat rooms and reading the blogs they were reading and listening to the podcast they were sharing back and forth, and trying to get a sense of kind of where they were at. And because I kept really meticulous notes through that whole period and continue to do that to this day, putting together a timeline wasn't terribly difficult because I was able to kind of archive things and get copies of things in real time versus a challenge that is much more difficult, which is, you know, if something bad happens, then scrambling to kind of go back in time and like get things before people delete them or before platforms take them down or people get kicked off of things. So having like a daily active accounting of what we were seeing really helped us put together a really comprehensive timeline after January 6th.
Was there anything that was shocking, something unexpected? I feel like when your daily is like just, you know, rigorous note keeping and documentation, it just, there's hardly any surprises anymore. But was there anything when you were going sort of, you know, examining the 2020 election, was there something that really just popped out to you and was kind of like, oh my gosh, this is wild?
I think some of the alliance building was really curious to me. Anti-vax people suddenly being cool with like the Oath Keepers and like more moderate Republican crowds thinking, you know, the Proud Boys were chill because when they watch Fox News, they see, you know, this looping riot footage and they think, oh, you know, these are our bodyguards against Antifa tonight, you know, and like sort of the bread breaking that was going on. That is kind of one of the main things I think that had stuck with me through that period of, you know, when I was talking to folks or that we were working with on some of these issues, just being like something kind of messed up is going on here, because these people normally, you know, maybe they tolerate each other or look the other way, but like right now they seem to like really kind of be digging each other and like working together on things. And that's never a good sign. when you start having different like extremist groups or extremist movements, you know, setting aside their differences and collaborating, you get a lot more numbers in the mix, a lot, and it becomes a lot less predictable, and you know, the risk of violence shoots up. So I think that was kind of what was striking to me from that period of time. And then I guess today I just continue to be both completely like cynical as a person. So not feeling like shocked, but still being kind of surprised at where some of these, you know, ideologies and talking points can crop up, you know, going like during the Supreme Court nominees hearing that just took place, you know, the talk of like pedophilia and grooming and stuff, like it's just wild to me that's like mainstream discourse now.
It's interesting, like the information ecosystem, because it seems like on and sort of one telling of the story, like when we sat down with Amanda Moore, she made it kind of clear that, you know, you had the Q guys over here, you had the Fash guys over here, they might interact, but in reality, they don't. And then you hear other stories like how the Christian identity movement is slowly, you know, working its way into QAnon. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when we think about the information ecosystem being reflected into alliance building, you know, I guess the first question I have here is like, where does QAnon fall? Where does that sort of, that constellation of conspiracy theorists fall? Are people just making fun of them? Are they kind of the glue that binds everything else? Like, how do we understand Q's role in this, you know, how do we understand Q's role? And then how do we understand like more generalized conspiracy theories and conspiracy building?
Yeah, I think for people outside of Q, even in the far right, it's kind of a mockery. Like if I'm on Telegram, like any given week, like there's this meme that a bunch of the white nationalists like to post whenever there's like bad news or they're getting really negative in their propaganda about the world falling down into the trenches. That it's like a old QAnon meme from one of the image boards that's like Trump sitting there and it's like, oh, if you think this is crazy, grab the popcorn, you'll never guess what's next, or something like that. So it can be kind of a mockery in a lot of parts of the right. I think there's still that uniting mythos there, though, of Trump being the sort of strong man figure that is going to, you know, throw a middle finger to the rules, to the, you know, normal, polite political order, to the establishment, and, you know, tear stuff up, and, you know, that is going to make things better somehow. And I think that's kind of uniting. Where QAnon kind of fits into the far right more broadly, I think, can be a bit harder to say. In its early days, the QAnon movement was a little bit more monolithic. There were divisions even in the early days, but generally it was kind of all the same, or you had maybe like four or five different little factions, whether it's like the super religious guys or like the InfoWars crew or the people who are really into like numerology. You had a few different camps, but generally like it was all super focused on the Q drops. So it was all, they were all kind of talking about the same thing. But today the QAnon movement is kind of in a post Q state. And I would argue that they were probably in a post Q state going into like January 6th and going into the election, because Q had been like MIA for a bit, or like posting very sparsely. And, you know, the movement kind of evolved to be this big tent conspiracy movement. So today you've got like folks that are still part of these broader online networks of like QAnon belief, you know, influencers that used to very aggressively push QAnon content. You've got, you know, the religious guys, you've got UFO guys, alternative medicine guys. That's a big one in the COVID era. And you've just got so many different subsects and factions. There's like a million different on ramps into this kind of into the big tent that it's hard to really talk about it as a monolith anymore, because you can have portions of the Q movement that like bicker with each other or disagree fiercely, like Jordan Sather, who's a guy who spent a lot of time hyping up Q, you know, was just constantly getting into it with other conspiracy theorists. Like this morning I was like watching him just rip into this guy who had claimed Anthony Fauci was arrested. And like that kind of fighting amongst themselves, I think it makes it hard to talk about the movement as one thing anymore.
It's interesting, the concept of the on-ramp into the big tent, because it seems like that on-ramp, for normies at least, always seems to be a conspiracy theory. Am I correct? I mean, like, I feel like it was first Q in the Trump years, then it's like CRT, then it's Disney is grooming the children. It just seems like that on-ramp into the far right for the normies, it's almost always conceptualized as a conspiracy theory, or are, you know, do people come to the far right for other reasons? I mean, when I say other people, I mean like, you know, nonviolent kind of somebody you would consider a normie or kind of a generally non-political person.
Yeah, I think it's like distrust, I think, is sort of the uniting factor of these on-ramps, because if we're going to distill these on-ramps down, mix them all in one giant pot, evaporate all the filler out of it, what you get is this belief that there is some kind of elite society pulling the strings of the country, of the world, in ways that damage it, that damage your quality of life, that damage the, you know, whatever vision of, you know, the United States of America you may have, and that, you know, this is being done in plain sight and society is crumbling, etc., which is not a belief that people who still have faith in society come to. And I think for the normie or the disengaged person, one of the you know, precursors, maybe not an on-ramp in itself, but like a precursor of that, is feeling kind of isolated or feeling like the table of society is stacked against you. And there's certainly like plenty of reasons in our modern world to feel that way, whether it is like crushing student loan debt, millennials not being able to afford to buy homes and like start families and stuff like they might normally. Wages stagnating. I mean, there's a whole host of like valid reasons. There's also a whole host of like not valid reasons, like maybe people's personal racial anxieties or bigoted attitudes that play into the mix as well. And you know, I think all of that kind of contributes to this sense that, you know, things are not as they seem. It's like a disillusionment. And like when people become disillusioned and cynical, I think there's like a whole host of like conspiracy theory influencers or like online propagandists or like media figures who are happy to come along and try to exploit that. So in the same sense, I think kind of a way to address it is to address legitimate social ills and social disorder that exists in the US, and also to make sure people have access to information that is quality, and to do what we can to the extent that we can to promote feelings of trust in that information. Because if people are doing good and they feel good about, you know, what they're seeing, what they're hearing, and, you know, can use that to make good choices and improve their life, et cetera, I think the window or the, I always abuse metaphors, but maybe I'll try this one. The slope becomes a bit less slippery.
I mean, what kind of fascinates me about, you know, the conspiracy theory as the on-ramp is how elite driven it is. So when I think about conspiracy theories that are like pushing people into political action, I think like, you know, I think of like Tucker Carlson or Alex Jones or Trump himself. So it seems like, you know, there is a lot of elite driven sort of pushing of those conspiracy theories, but at the same time, like, you can't really separate out the political agency, the political motive, and the grift, right? So Alex Jones is kind of the most famous example, but he was at least, you know, my understanding of it, he was making like hundreds of millions of dollars a year selling vitamins, you know, based on the fact that he was kind of constantly just pushing out conspiracy theories to his audience. But, you know, so there's like two questions here. One is, you know, how do we think about elite driven sort of pushing out conspiracy theories? And then the second point to that is, you know, how much of that conspiracy theory of pushing it out isn't necessarily genuine political belief, but rather related to a grift or some sort of money-making proposition?
I'll answer the second question first, which is, you know, I tend to think that whether it is genuine or not, like whether somebody like Tucker Carlson or Alex Jones really believes the things that they say to their viewers, I think it's much less important than the effect that it has. You know, these are audiences that, you know, when you have such a huge platform and you're espousing those kind of conspiratorial beliefs or bigoted beliefs, it's, you know, agitating the audience like that. It's kind of just like a numbers game. You know, of course, people who watch it are not brainwashed. You know, if I watch a Tucker Carlson clip, I don't turn it off and go, wow, you know what? I guess I just think something completely different than what I thought before now. But there's always people's agency, of course, but there's also a lot of audience priming that happens, you know, through the repetition of these conspiracy theories or repetitions of the premises of those theories. And also the audience that Alex Jones cultivated, especially over the last 5 years, and certainly folks like Tucker Carlson being on a partisan news channel have cultivated are just that. They're hyper-partisan. So, you know, they have some, you know, beliefs or belief structure kind of baked into the audience. So if we're talking about that numbers game, the, you know, probability that it's going to hit ends up going higher. It's like playing, you know, roulette. And if you're trying to bet on red, if you start, you know, putting more red slots on the roulette wheel, your chances of hitting go higher. And when it comes to conspiracy theories or extreme rhetoric, the consequences are also kind of a numbers game. So I think that is kind of what seems so alarming about a lot of it is it's not just that, you know, Tucker Carlson is espousing great replacement theory, but that great replacement theory has motivated a lot of really heinous violence in the past. And if we think even just 0.0001% of people that hear that stuff are going to feel compelled to any kind of violent action, the more exposure it gets, it just becomes a riskier situation. So it's, you know, I kind of see them as sentiment builders and also like risk exploders.
That's interesting because like we're now getting into the idea of agency and organization. And like, you know, this might be a spicy take, but you know, what worries me isn't so much the 0.001, you know, percent that are going to, you know, go out and commit violence, but rather, you know, the type of person that would kind of use Jones and Carlson as kind of informing their political beliefs. And then they go translate that to, you know, protesting at the school board or voting for Marjorie Taylor Greene, or in the most extreme sense, you know, participating in 1-6. So in that sense, you know, how do we understand, do we understand Jones and Carlson as constituency builders? Or maybe a more thematic question would be, you know, when does the political right come in and kind of take advantage of the Carlson and Jones audience for political means, for political reasons?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I was getting to when I use the term sentiment building, right? There's, of course, the risk of violence through, you know, whatever individual may come into contact with that stuff and believe it whole hog. That's always going to be a risk. And I think sort of answering the, answering the sentiment element there is a bit trickier and is kind of where I see this field of research, you know, trying to wrap its head around what it looks like to talk about that and think about that, and then do something about it, which is that, you know, if the broader constituency is getting loaded up with this stuff and then, you know, being compelled or called on to participate in the political system, like what kind of negative or corrosive effect would that have? And it's something that, you know, kind of becomes a more and more urgent question, I think, especially as we've seen, you know, broader GOP causes really not shy away from trying to tap into those constituencies and, or rather, you know, kind of appealing directly to them, whether it is protests over the last week outside of Disney properties, because, you know, they believe or they're agitating that Disney is pro pedophilia in some way, you know, Pizzagate-ish esque stuff, or it's, you know, sending people to yell at the school board or yell at the health board with COVID conspiracy theories, or, you know, all kinds of, you know, weird claims about racial history education. And, you know, what that can mean. And we're starting to see some of those corrosive effects already, you know, whether it is people who were otherwise engaged in, you know, thankless public service, like being on school boards or being on election boards, resigning in wake of threats or in wake of just chaos and, you know, attention they didn't really sign up for and certainly don't get paid enough for, if they get paid at all. And then, you know, kind of folks who think like this, you know, people who, you know, follow the doctrine of somebody like Steve Bannon being very explicit about trying to secure positions on election boards. And, you know, I think it's going to be interesting, but certainly terrible to see what the consequences of that could be. I imagine, you know, the midterms will probably be a bit prickly as far as the consequences of that kind of thing playing out. And I certainly think 2024, we're going to see it play out very pronounced. But it's, this, you know, constituency building, it's kind of creating this like small army of totally pilled people to go in and sort of junk things up. And, you know, if they're not, you know, actively cramming through harmful policy or whatever, at least junking up the systems to where they can't, you know, function as intended.
So I'm taking this as the Boberts and the Greens and the Gosars of the world are the future. I mean, that's kind of scary.
Well, I don't know if it is the future overall. I don't have a crystal ball, of course, that I can stare into. Otherwise, I would just like whip that puppy out and I'd say, hey, check it out. We're about to look into the future here. And I'd probably make a ton of money and, you know, have all kinds of influence. Everyone would want to get a glance in the crystal ball. But I don't think that the GOP has done really much of anything to dissuade this kind of stuff. And it instead, you know, as I mentioned before, you have folks like Marjorie Taylor Greene, people like Wendy Rogers, a very extreme senator from in the Arizona Congress, you know, rising up to be some of the biggest stars in the party. So I think, you know, having that happen without any sort of consequence, without any sort of meaningful pushback, without a unified voice from that side of the aisle saying, no, actually, we're not going to do this, I think it's just going to beget more of it. And if the constituency is down with this stuff, they're going to vote that way, too. So I definitely think, you know, we're probably going to see more Lauren Boberts and Marjorie Taylor Greens before we start seeing less of them.
I do think that's, it's kind of a struggle to explain to people that, like, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene is a great fundraiser. Lauren Boebert is a great fundraiser. And it's just like, you know, despite their rhetoric, they're actually, it almost seems like they're a net benefit for the Republican Party. They're bringing in money, they're bringing in attention.
They're success stories.
Success stories, yes.
Yeah.
That's wild. I mean, like you referred to Wendy Rogers, and if I remember correctly, she's the one who kind of gave the thumbs up to Nick Fuentes, the racist guy. But I mean, that's kind of wild, that interaction with, that seems to be like a direct interaction between an elected, you know, party member and the far right.
Yeah, and she did get censured by her colleagues in the Arizona Senate, which is a very damning finger wag, but doesn't actually like mean that she's out of office or anything. So she did have like some consequence, but it was more symbolic than anything, really, I think.
I mean, like, I can't stop being fascinated by Green and Boebert because they're not effective. My understanding is that they're not effective House members. They're not writing legislation. They're not trying to improve the lives of their constituents. I mean, I remember Boebert's kind of CPR, the Colorado Public Radio interview, and she was just like, just all over the place. It wasn't like, she didn't feel like a typical politician where it's like, I want to do this for my constituents. I want to do, you know, improve my community. It was just like all over the place. And then a reiteration of conspiracies and memes. So I guess like, you know, how do we sort of judge or conceptualize people like Green and Boebert and Gosar? Do we think of them as just vessels for conspiracy theories and memes, or do we have to actually regard them as real politicians, as people that we should expect would write laws, pass laws, make that sort of attempt? Or they're just so hyper-partisan that that sort of thing doesn't really matter?
Well, they're in office right now. You know, Gosar, Green, and Boebert are all part of the House, which is very firmly Democrat majority. So, you know, it in a way, it's almost like not really that productive for them to try to suggest policy, because it, you know, being who they are and being, you know, believing what they believe, it's very unlikely that it would pass. So instead, you get, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene seemingly every few weeks introducing articles of impeachment against Joe Brandon or Joe Biden, whatever. But but you know, for the most part, they're just party line votes. You know, there's some. I don't think they are even really terribly active on committees, but I do think we have to take them seriously. You know, if that power balance were to change and a Republican majority did come into Congress, which it very well may after the 2022 midterms, you know, that is a open question still, you know, particularly with gerrymandering and, you know, district maps being recut in some key places. So it's not unthinkable to think that, you know, folks like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert could very potentially have like a real vehicle to advance some stuff. And rhetorically, at least in the meantime, building up that sentiment and building kind of a space for other parts of government controlled by people who are like-minded to, you know, kind of push through a bunch of bills that maybe they might not have been comfortable trying to push through, you know, 5 years ago. We're seeing a whole host of states getting really, really aggressive on the anti-abortion front. I mean, they've been trying for a long time, but really, really going for it now. Same thing with, you know, CRT bans, you know, using that as a vehicle to ban certain literature or to, you know, kind of tighten up the squeeze on public education, which has been a long-term project. So even if, you know, they don't have this whole resume to their name, they can still be effective political figures in non-traditional senses. So I think it can seem a bit silly on its face. It's hard to like look at Marjorie Taylor Greene and not just like kind of, at least from my perspective, like kind of just like cringe and feel like kind of weird about it. But you know, it's not like what she's doing has no effect. She's not just, you know, screaming into the wind. You know, at the very, very least, she's part of a broader, you know, information ecosystem, I guess you could say, a sentiment ecosystem, a constituency that is, you know, moving the rhetoric forward and getting a ton of eyeballs on that rhetoric and, you know, exposing more people and normalizing it.
That's interesting to me that you pointed out that, you know, she's successful in sort of the rhetoric and the sentiment. And we kind of can see that in state houses and in the House. But, you know, I'm thinking about the Senate and sort of how, you know, Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley are kind of reproducing the rhetoric of, you know, okay groomer, or the claims of rampant, you know, enabling pedophilia or whatever. But, you know, is there kind of a limit or to a kind of a political failure to this sentiment, like as you kind of move up, right? So that it's, you know, to the Senate or to executive offices, is there like a limit or a failing to this? Or is it just, we have to kind of conceptualize it as, you know, the audience is ever expanding. It just has to find the right moment to act.
You know, I think as this becomes more normalized, the audience kind of grows, even if the audience isn't, you know, parroting this stuff and repeating this stuff verbatim, at least like being desensitized to it, or, you know, picking up kind of the vibe of it. And the more people that kind of pick up that vibe, the more that politicians at higher levels, I think, are going to feel obligated or to view it as politically expedient to appeal to that kind of vibe. But I don't know, man, it's everything's on the table as far as I'm concerned. It's we saw a lot of stuff in the last like 5 years of politics that people didn't think they were going to see. And I don't think we're at the end of the story yet, that at the end of this moment in American politics. I hope it ends soon. It's kind of a nerve-wracking moment to be in. It's a bit more contentious than I would like it to be. But it's, yeah, I don't know. I think my general point of view is kind of still that it's probably going to get stupider and badder before it starts to get a whole lot better.
I mean, there seems to be some positivity, right? So the Proud Boys, the prosecution against the Proud Boys and against the Oath Keepers, Alex Jones, you know, being sued for hundreds of millions of dollars, the defamation, the Sandy Hook defamation suits. But I mean, from your perspective, do you, you know, is there a glimmer of light? Is there a glimmer of hope? What sort of gives you hope here?
Yeah, well, you know, I guess it kind of goes back to what I was saying at the very start, which is that we have like more people and more political will and political capital to try to do something about these issues now than any time that I've been working on this stuff. You know, the first half of my career was, you know, kind of spent just trying to convince people that what I was covering and what I was writing about was actually important in the like national political picture. And like we kind of seem to get it now and, you know, treat it more appropriately now. It's certainly not perfect. You know, I certainly wish there was kind of, you know, more crosstalk, because I don't think the Republican Party is like totally lost. And I think because, you know, that pushback I was talking about that I wish I saw more of, you know, coming from leaders and voices in the Republican Party is absent, I think it would be beneficial to kind of salvage what we can there and try to make amends where we can. And you know, have an alternative message of like unity and like pro-democracy and inclusion, and like have a better counter narrative to this stuff instead of just reacting to it all the time. I think there is a glimmer of hope though, because I'm a firm believer in the idea that the arc of history bends towards justice. And I think we're starting to see it bend a bit. In that direction. I say it's going to get stupider and badder before it gets better, because I don't think like the arc has totally bent yet and we're on the other side of that slope. But I do think things tend to go that way. And I also, you know, have to remind myself sometimes that, you know, this stuff, even though it's very loud, even though it is not as obscure as we might want to think that it is all the time, that it is, you know, being exposed to all these new people and more people are starting to think like that. As we talk today, it still is in the minority. More people don't believe this stuff than do believe this stuff. And, you know, in this moment, I think people care. I think people care enough. And I think if we can, you know, encourage people to become participants rather than bystanders, there's still a lot of hope for us.
Interesting. So for the kind of next question, I want to switch footing, and I kind of want to, it's going to be very meta, but when covering the far right and the extremist right, how do we sort of cover it without being partisan? I know the previous 45 minutes has literally just been about the Republican Party and its nexus with the extreme and far right, and now I'm asking you about how do we, you know, not have it come off as partisan. I mean, and kind of the reason I ask is, like, I think one of the big critiques of how the right is covered is the tendency to both sides, right? So I think this is like the New York Times, like, you know, the critique of them is that you're both sidesing the issue, you know, for the sake of being even and even handed, you're giving equal time to, you know, an extremist sort of opinion or idea. But in your approach, you know, is it important to cover both sides, or is it more, you know, you're going to cover 1-6, you're going to explain what happened, you're not going to go out and search for like a counter idea or counter opinion? How do you cover something that is partisan without being partisan, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, I mean, the way I look at it, it's triage. Like, I certainly have my own personal, like, moral vision and sense of right and wrong, and that guides my work. You know, I have my own opinions on things, of course, but, like, when it comes down to getting this work done, it's all triage to me. You know, if there was an explosion in, like, left-wing, you know, extreme left arsons, or, you know, eco-terrorism or something, then my work would take me there. But for now, where I sit, you know, this what's happening on the American right, I think, is sort of the predominant thing that worries me. So it's where I have devoted my time in this field for the most part so far. And as far as being partisan, you know, I try to avoid that by just keeping it as literal as possible, showing people in their own words, not saying things that, you know, if somebody challenged me on them, that I couldn't, you know, whip out a whole booklet of receipts to back up, or at least to explain why, you know, I had the take that I did. And I also, you know, again, to loop it back to the very beginning, you know, we're talking about definitions, being specific and being, you know, as literal as possible in the ways that we talk about this is also something that I try to push for, and something that I try to exemplify in my own work. So talking about somebody like Nick Fuentes, the white nationalist, you know, if I'm writing about him, it's not far-right influencer Nick Fuentes. He certainly is far-right, but really what he is a white nationalist. And there's a whole, you know, plethora of things to cite of him in his own words explaining why that's true. So being specific, being literal, as far as both sides, you know, it's, I don't try to draw equivalences because my philosophy is triage. You know, I'm looking for what I think is the biggest threat, what demonstrates itself to be the biggest threat, and act accordingly. You know, it's one day I may be, you know, the leading anarchist car bomber researcher if things go that way. Hopefully they don't, but I kind of go where I see the threat. And if people want to call me an activist or call me a partisan or a hack or whatever, that's their opinion. I'm going to keep doing the work that I do. I'm very proud of the work that I do. And I think it, you know, most of it tends to hold up exceptionally well. And it's, yeah, I, you know, tune out the haters, or what's the, there's like a Taylor Swift song, right? The haters gonna hate, something like that.
Something like that. I mean, to your point, like, I find that in the production of the podcast, that's kind of what we've been doing is like, you know, the biggest threat, because I think like we've had comments where people have said, like, why don't you look at the left? Why don't you look at these political figures? And it's like, well, you know, there isn't 60 years of history, you know, and, you know, there's not this constant cycle of violence with the left as it is with the right. And it's not as, you know, as threatening. It doesn't loom as large into our politics. I also find, like, in some ways, it's like when the few times that we've actually interviewed people from the right, it's been kind of weird. Like, there's not this, there's like this urge to own the libs, I guess. I don't know how to describe it, but it's like, it's very opportunistic about owning the libs and not necessarily examining the consequences. Like, I mean,
it's contrarianism is what it is.
Yeah.
Like, all of these, like, quote unquote Antifa experts, they're contrarians. Like, you get them in a room and all they can talk about is the media won't cover this or blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no, let's talk about some history. You know, you want to talk about some anarchist history, I'm all ears, but like, this isn't what you're doing.
Yeah. And it's just, it was so weird. Like, I just, like, for me, coming from a kind of academic and investigation background, it was just kind of like, huh. It made me kind of like, it was kind of a new kind of guy to run into, basically. And it was fascinating.
We live in a universe of many guys to run.
So I think we've gone for about an hour. So I have to ask you the legendary last question.
Oh shit, I don't know what this is.
Oh no. So the legendary last question is for you as the speaker, as the interviewee, to give us, the audience and the interviewer, something to chew on, something to think about, something to kind of, a last word or a last thought that we can sort of take with us and sort of think about after the show is done.
Oh man. Yeah, I exposed myself for not doing the prep work here. I would say, here's something to mull over. A better future is totally possible. It is entirely possible. People who don't want to see this stuff thrive are in the majority. And there are things that everyone can do. Like, something that struck me watching all these school board protests is how many rooms that, you know, whatever, you know, group of angry people showing up at these meetings, hooting and hollering with whatever, you know, claim they heard on Fox or saw on social media, is that oftentimes they were kind of doing that by themselves in the room. So, you know, kind of something that I would encourage people to think about is, you know, if you are not going to be a bystander here, if you're not going to, you know, just kind of sit here and, you know, watch the train wobble on its tracks, but think about doing something. You know, is it going to one of those school board meetings and, you know, just being the voice in the room that says, hey, actually, most of us don't think this. Thanks for all your work, you know, whatever. I don't I don't know what you would say, but is it, you know, getting active on a certain political issue that you care about? Is it, you know, trying to do what you can to encourage productive conversations, especially when people disagree? Is it, you know, trying to intervene or talk to people or make sure that, you know, everybody's doing okay? And like, you know, if people are falling in the conspiracy world, you know, pulling them aside and, you know, asking them about it, that sort of thing, you know, it's just kind of doing what you can to be a better participant in society. Cause I think that's what we need right now. It's like a bunch of people being better society members, because we live in a society, right? But so I would give that to chew on, which is, you know, what would that look like for you? For me, it's doing research and trying to get that research into the hands of people that are, you know, making policy, or in the hands of reporters that are, you know, covering things for larger audiences, and, you know, trying to shape it and inform things that way. What's it look like for you?
Awesome. Wise words. That was Jared Holt. Again, thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Of course.